Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond the sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Elizabeth Sando, who already joined us twice on episodes 18 and 61 and talked about the essential elements of washoku, as well as the unique concepts of ichimotsu zenshoku and tsukushi kondate. Elizabeth is a food writer and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has been in Japan for the last 50 years. And she runs the culinary art program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. So if you haven't planned to Japan, the trip to Japan, maybe you can just think of joining her program. It's called A Taste of Culture. And Elizabeth is also the author of 6 cookbooks, including the award-winning Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Kitchen, published in 2005. And today's topic is Japanese pickles, or tsukemono. Japanese tsukemono is unique, and it's not just brined or cured in vinegar, but also made with unique pickling agents such as katsu. And the diversity of Japanese pickles is pretty amazing. So today, we'll discuss different kinds of Japanese pickling techniques, regional varieties of tsukemono, and easy recipes that you can try, and much, much more. But quickly, before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher's podcast. So please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review on iTunes and Stitcher, and we really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org. And today's topic, tsukemono, is actually requested by one of our listeners. So thank you so much. Now, let's start our conversation with Elizabeth Sando. Hello, Elizabeth. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you're back visiting the U.S. So what is it for this time?
A number of things. We're actually going up to Boston tomorrow. Mm. I'm going to be doing a program for the culinary historians up there and also for Milk Street, cooking class. But when you asked me about tsukemono, I was delighted because it's the kind of thing that people seem to be very interested in, but they don't really quite get a handle on it. Mm. And the difference between Japanese tsukemono and what most people think of as pickles.
Right, like cucumber in a jar.
Right.
Kind of.
And most people have an image of either salt and or vinegar being used, and I think that's pretty common around the world. But there are a lot of, I don't know that they're unique to Japan, but they're certainly distinctive, and they characterize Japanese world of tsukemono, but different, I call them agents of change, and it sounds a little sinister, as if, you know, some other agency was going to come and talk to us. But indeed, that's what they are. They make changes happen to the ingredients. And I think one of the things that I found so remarkable about tsukemono was that the length of time that it took to make them could be as quick as today, I'm going to show you 20 minutes, or it could be as long as narazuke is probably the longest, and it's several years.
Oh, wow.
Really delayed gratification before they reach eating pleasure.
Interesting. Right. So I think, you know, last time in episode 61, right. you talked about ichimotsu zenshoku, which I think is not to waste anything, and the preserving is something valuable in Japanese culture. So tsukemono is
also. It is. And being able to use something over a period of time. Mm-hmm. So one of the other points or probably if anybody out there has tried to make any kind of Japanese tsukemono, they've realized that there are sort of different stages in that transformation. Mm. And there's the raw ingredient, and then the point at which you know that it's no longer raw, something has happened to it. Heat hasn't been applied, but something has happened to it. But it might not yet be mellow and delicious and fully flavored, and it takes a bit longer to reach that mature eating pleasure stage. Mm. But then the problem often is, how long can you hold it there? So not all Japanese tsukemono are preserves. Mm. And I can't believe that many of them were with the notion of extending shelf life. Mm. I think that many of them were created, if you will, or discovered, happened because of the eating pleasure possibilities, a different way of changing and transforming their ingredients, but not necessarily to extend shelf life.
Mm, interesting, because I think lately in the States also, like especially like Brooklyn Kombucha Company or that kind of thing, fermented food is the way to make umami more expressed in food.
Right.
So I think that bacteria-based cultured food is something we haven't looked at deeply enough.
Right. I probably would call it round flavor or complex.
Mm.
And there's no doubt about it, but that some of these organisms create a more complex and fuller flavor, more satisfaction about it. But not all of them help deter spoilage. Mm-hmm. And many people think of pickles or other preserves, sweet preserves like jams or jellies, as things that really last a terribly long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always true about Japanese tsukemono.
Okay.
It's a lot of them are of the moment.
Mm, okay, yeah. Like a cherry blossoms.
Yes, that is a good point. I think it is very much a cherry blossom attitude towards food.
So like a very not eternal.
No,
enjoy the moment.
Enjoy the moment, right.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the details in a moment.
Right.
But first of all, what is, by definition, what is tsukemono? That's the
mono is a thing, and skeru describes the process of transformation.
Mm.
And what's interesting is when you write it in the calligraphy, it has a sanzuihen or a liquid on the left. So most of them are brine, or eventually a liquid is drawn out from the natural moisture of the food.
Mm.
But it's a transformed thing.
Right. What I think typically people, you know, in the States might think of gari, like a ginger in that sushi place. That's a classic, like, basic tsukemono.
Okay. Right. Certainly, that's two things that are specific to that style of tsukemono. One is that a bit of heat has been applied, so the ginger is briefly blanched. And the reason for doing that is not so much to make it tender as it is to kill off a certain enzyme that would interfere with the flavor development.
Interesting.
And also to allow it to stay fresh longer.
Mm.
So if you don't quickly blanch it before you put it in this sweet and sour sauce, something called amazu, to pickle it, it will spoil quickly, and it will never really develop the flavor of the amazu.
Right. So it's kind of, in a way, the bacteria management, and you have to know.
It is. It is. And there are a few tsukemono that are not technically raw nama.
Okay.
They have been briefly zapped with heat, usually by dipping it in boiling water.
Right. Okay, and I was looking at some history, and it's the tsukemono can go back as far as 10,000 years in Japan. And 8th century, they already had very popular dishes like eggplant and the squash tsukemono. And the people have been a bit familiar with tsukemono.
Yes, indeed. Right. Interesting. Eggplant, it really is an ancient vegetable, one of the first that was really cultivated. And there are so many different kinds of eggplant tsukemono. Mm. Probably the most commonly recognized is shibazuke, and in Kyoto probably listeners have had it. It's that sort of purpley pink, very usually it's been very finely chopped. Most of it's eggplant, a little bit might be ginger or myoga, which is related to ginger, and udi, which is a gourd, but it's more like a cucumber. And it's been colored and flavored with something called akajiso. So a lot of people are familiar with the green shiso leaf, but a related plant, the akajiso, is used, and that's what gives pickle plums their color as well.
Okay. Yeah, I just purchased for the summer gardening, I purchased a purple shiso.
Wow.
So maybe they can use
it. Well, I was going to recommend or suggest that people can do that. Shiso is fairly easy to grow on your own. And if you do and you grow regular shiso, let it grow to seed so that you get the hojiso, the very top. You'll see these little almost bell-like pieces. And if you take those off and add them to things like salad, we're going to actually be making a little quick pickle here in the studio, and you add those into it, it's a wonderful flavor. But the akajiso for pickling is usually massaged with salt and bled. It bleeds a color more intense than beet juice.
So it breaks down the fiber and then
And anybody who does any dyeing of fabric or yarn, akajiso's terrific. Gorgeous, gorgeous pinky purple color. But the leaves themselves are used for pickling, and they do have antibacterial properties. So after the pickling process is finished, the shiso leaves, the akajiso leaves, are dried and pulverized, made into a powder. It's called yukari. And it's sprinkled on rice, especially in the summer, to prevent spoilage.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So color and the spoilage prevention.
Yes,
you
indeed.
You can do better than that. So I just wanted to mention that, you know, that you mentioned Kyoto.
Yes.
And Nishiki Market in Kyoto.
Yes.
So I still remember, like, there is a, like, the couple tsukemono shops, and you can taste pretty much everything.
Yes.
And it's so colorful that you can't help pictures for Instagram. Seriously, it's really beautiful.
It is beautiful, and usually people try, when they're serving tsukemono, to have two, probably three different kinds, and they're probably different colors and different, slightly different methods for making the pickle. So a variety of them, and they are. Tsukemono is probably my favorite course in a meal.
Okay. So now I see you got amazing ingredients to the studio.
I do.
So maybe we can do a quick pickle.
Can I start?
Please.
Can people hear that? I chopped up some hakusai. It was sold at a local Japanese food market.
Right, Napa cabbage, Chinese cabbage.
Right, Napa cabbage. And the package on the outside said it was a little more than a pound. So I decided to use about a hefty tablespoon of salt. So I have it in a sturdy, resealable bag.
It's a bag, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to put it on my lap. And the pieces themselves are about, I'm not great on inches, but about an inch and a half. I'm used to metric. An inch and a half or so pieces. And I'm about to sprinkle in
just like coarse sea salt?
Very coarse salt. It was sold as kosher salt. It seemed to be probably the best or the closest. In Japan, I would use sea salt known as enden, which is really evaporated seawater. And it has lots of minerals in it. So now we're going to just sort of loosely close the top.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to pretend I have sore shoulders and I'm massaging them. That's just about the right amount of pressure.
Right. I wish I was the
bag instead. Well, I don't know. So as soon as I do that, some liquid starts to come out.
Mm.
And you see that there's a little bit of liquid.
Right.
And as soon as I have a little bit of liquid, I'm ready to add any other ingredients that I want.
Mm.
So the salt is the essential mm-hmm. part to get the process going, and it's drawing out the natural liquids that are in the vegetable, in this case the haksai.
Right.
And what I've decided to add almost always is kombu. Kombu is sort of the essence of umami, that potential.
Mm.
And I have a piece, it's about two and a half inches square, and it's dried, so I'm breaking it into pieces. And sometimes I will cut them very, very thin, like with the scissors, and sometimes I'll keep them larger so that they're easy to pull out afterwards.
Mm.
The kombu is going to be tough, so either it has to be extremely thin,
mm-hmm.
or it has to be big enough that you can pull it out afterwards.
Right.
So once you've got a little bit of liquid happening from the massaging, we can add the kombu. And then the other thing I was going to add was togarashi, a chili pepper, just to add a little bit of spice.
Right.
Depending upon how much heat you do or do not want, I've got a whole one here, and I'm breaking it in half, she said, struggling. There we go. And I'm taking out a few of the extra seeds so that it doesn't become overwhelmingly hot.
Right.
I myself do not have a mouth of asbestos, and I tend to do things a little bit on the milder side.
Okay.
But again, I'm leaving it big enough now that we can pull it out
right.
afterwards. If you were going to want to keep it in and serve it that way, probably cutting very, very thin pieces
okay.
is the better way.
Right.
So
it's only in big Ziploc and the napa cabbage, kombu, salt, and then the togarashi pepper. That's
right.
it. And
that's it.
In the studio, there's no water, anything.
There's nothing else, folks. And now, so that it's not too noisy, as I continue to massage.
Right.
If you've got somebody who's sort of offering to help in the kitchen but doesn't really want to do a whole lot, give them a bag of this to squeeze.
Right.
or even the kids, if they're watching TV. If they're playing a game, they need their thumbs for other things.
Right.
But it would work. And we're going to get it just a little bit more wilted and then really tighten it up and just leave it for about minimum of 20 minutes. And it could be a couple of hours. If it was going to be a very warm day, or your kitchen tends to be very warm, I'd probably put it in the fridge for a couple of hours.
Right.
And it'll be salad-like, but a delightful salad that doesn't need a dressing,
right.
In about 30 minutes.
Mm.
And 2 or 3 days later, it'll be more fermented,
right.
and it will be more like a tsukemono.
Okay. So
and
within,
it'll keep for a week.
Right. So within 20 minutes, it's still a breaking down process. So it's
right.
not the bacteria activated, but 2 or 3 days, it's more like I think lactic acid.
Lactic acid is the first and most obvious change that takes place.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So we're gonna.
Okay. And so that's the basic salt cured.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And then so in 20 minutes we're gonna check what's gonna
right.
happen.
Indeed.
Right. So the other than the salt based, what are the other kind of agents can make tsukemono?
Well, the first that you mentioned about the ginger, the vinegar, sometimes it's vinegar alone, but usually it's in combination with sugar, so there is a sort of a sweet and sour.
Mm.
And sometimes it is just a sweet and sour liquid, and it's submerged in there, and again, it's a question of waiting.
Mm-hmm.
It could be as quick, I'm trying to think of something like kohaku namasu at New Year's time, the daikon and carrot
right.
Salad. That could be ready in 20 minutes as
oh, wow.
well. Yeah. But you could make it 2 or 3 days ahead of time and keep it in the refrigerator.
But again, if you buy leaving the simple vinegar or salt-based bacteria, lactic acid, and maybe something out of each ingredient.
Yes, and in the example of this red and white salad that's usually used served at New Year's, there's also usually citron, yuzu skin that's added to it, or sometimes mekan peel or others. And so you have some of the citrus overtones as well and some of whatever that natural fermentation that happens from there. But I think one of the classic Japanese agents of change is something called koji, and it's recently caught the attention of a number of people,
right.
And it's likely that you could buy the paste. It's I'm going to pronounce it wrong. Aspergillus.
Yeah.
I really can't pronounce it. So it's easier to say in koji in Japanese. It can be a dry, but it's likely that you're going to see it as a loose paste. It might look a little bit like loose oatmeal.
Right. So it's basically malted rice.
Yes.
Right? It's malted with salt.
It is. Salt, again, is that initial agent of change. Mm-hmm. Once the these good bacteria that we can't pronounce properly get to work, they create a medium that in which you can submerge other things. You can also mix it and toss it with them.
Right.
And there are many different kinds of tsukemono that use koji as the agent of change, particularly in areas that produce sake and a lot of rice that is used for sake. So a lot of the Tohoku has koji-based tsukemono.
Right. Can I say one thing? Because I made a shokoji myself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's good. In New York, there is a koji, you know, the kind of like a base.
The base?
Yeah, yeah, and then you can just add salt.
Right.
And you just basically mix it for like a week.
Right.
Nothing else. And then it lasts like 6 months, and I put meat or fish in it overnight, and as if I'm a good chef, I can cook everything, any kind of protein.
It tenderizes. So what koji will do, you have to use just a little and use it well, I think. it will make a great difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the kind of marinade that you want to leave it in there for too terribly long, because it will begin to break down all of the protein and the fiber, and you're going to lose everything to the medium rather than have the meat or the fish taste good. But it's a great kind of flavoring to add when you don't have a whole lot of time.
Right.
So even just putting out a surface, maybe it's clear plastic wrap, putting a little bit of koji on top of it, putting a piece of fish or meat, a little bit of koji on top of that, closing up the wrap and waiting 10 minutes before you would broil it, grill it, or sear it in a pan is enough to make a huge difference in the roundness of the flavor. If you've got the time to be able to put it in overnight, it would be great, but it doesn't have to even be that long for koji.
But that is shiokoji, right? So the koji, that the one you, sorry, I kind of that, you know, diverted. But so the koji is malted rice, and you can mix koji. In my case, I mix with salt. But then you can mix with miso and other things.
You can. Salt. Usually what is sold as what I referred to as sort of a loose paste is shiokoji.
Okay.
And there's a fair amount of liquid that eventually gets produced. And how much of that is going to land up in the package when it's actually sold commercially changes vastly here in America, the products that I've seen.
Right.
Most of the prepared shiokoji that you buy in markets in Japan is a very thick paste.
Right.
And sometimes people will thin it out for themselves. Few people in Japan, because it's easy to buy this paste, will actually make the shiokoji themselves with the salt and the koji.
So koji is like really one unique thing. And I think really want to talk about nukazuke.
Yes. So the other is nuka. And it does go back to this notion of using food fully. And nuka is what is removed from the rice when it is polished to make white rice. Mm. So it's really the bran, the rice bran. And as a powder, it doesn't seem to have a great deal of interest or power to it. But mix it with a little bit of liquid and get it going, and it's the most amazing. When people come to programs in my kitchen in Tokyo, no matter what the program is, no matter what the meal is going to be, inevitably I will serve nukazuke. I've got a nuka pot that I've had for many, many years. And the first thing that I asked people is how long they think, what time did I put, it's usually cucumber, did I put the cucumber?
Wait, so the nuka, you know, it's funny thing, this having a nuka base or bed is like having a dog or a baby.
Yes.
Because you have to, once you, you know, that it's brand.
High maintenance.
Right, so you have a brand and you make a bed, right? So how do you make the bed?
Well, the liquid, it's easier to start with a starter, if somebody gives you a seed, a tane that's going to start it off. But often it's beer, and that's the most convenient way to start it, is with beer.
Sounds easy.
Yeah, you just pour it in and let it start in on it on its way. It has to be monitored. And I didn't think to put that up on my website, but I will when I go back today. I have a copy of an article I wrote for a Japanese newspaper, an English article for a Japanese newspaper, about my pickle pot. And it talks about how my starting, having to restart it.
I think I read it. It was amazing.
Yeah. So I'll put that up so that people can download that as well. But it is high maintenance. And as a matter of fact, I'm away from my pickle pot now for about 2 weeks.
Right.
And I developed ways of keeping it so that it didn't go off. But yes, it's in the refrigerator right now.
Okay.
It wouldn't be left at room temperature without somebody to monitor it every day.
So basically it's an aerobic bacteria that they have to mix it every day so that it's aired enough.
And when I remove the pot and I show people, I say, what do you see? And most of them don't comment on the fact that it's flat and patted down. And I point that out to them, that means that there's something actively pickling in there.
Okay.
When you're not actively using it, it needs to be aerated.
Okay.
You should never be patting it back down again. So most people, when they taste the cucumber, they guess, a couple of days. A few people say a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Almost always, it's less than 6 hours.
Okay.
So when I let them taste it, it does change depending upon the time of year.
Right.
And the warmer weather, it goes faster, and really only an hour and a half, 2 hours would be enough.
Okay.
And in the middle of winter, often after I finish dinner, I will put in what I need for the next night.
Okay, so basically, once you own that rice bran based nuka, that's N-U-K-A.
Right.
So once you have it, if it's, even if it's high maintenance, you can just throw it in, and the 6 hours, you have like cucumber or eggplant or daikon.
Right, and also turnips. I love turnips, kabu, when they are available. Any kind of turnip or radish is wonderful. And even the little red radishes are great. They're going to bleed a little bit, so some of that red, the pink will get in there, but it doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. So, nuka, N-U-K-A, listeners, if you want to try.
Right.
So, we can take a quick break here. And when you come back, we talk a little bit more about unique pickling agent of Japan and many more. So, please stay with us.
Bob's Red Mill is a proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and a big supporter of organic farmers. Ray and Tom Williams are two farmers who have worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray shares what their relationship with Bob's Red Mill means to them.
We thought that for over the long term, we thought it would make sense, better sense for the soil. Also, we thought that it was something that would improve the quality of the food supply. We're lucky in that we're working with Bob's Red Mill. We're part of a regional food network. With Bob is a fundamental relationship and cornerstone to that. We also work with other best-of-class people in the Northwest, and we're thankful for the long-term relationship that's brought good things to the soil and good things to our long-term farm economic plans. We appreciate his attitude toward absolutely high standard for the benefit of his customers. We take pride in meeting those standards.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Podcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Elizabeth Sando, a food writer and cookbook author and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo for the last 50 years. So we've been talking about unique Japanese pickling agents, and I think, of course, there are many types, but I think katsu,
yes.
Sake katsu, is really important to yes. talk about.
And again, it's not wanting to have anything go to waste. Mm. When you're making sake and you're pressing the mash, you drain off the liquid and that becomes the sake, but then you're left with the mash, the piece. And sake kasu, again, in Japan, is sold in two very different forms. One is ita, as sheets, and the other is as a paste.
Okay.
And if you're going to be trying to submerge something in it, getting it as a paste to begin with is probably the easiest way to manage it. But the ita, the actual sheets themselves, can be toasted and eaten as a snack.
Oh, wow.
Brushed with a little bit of soy sauce, and they're really delicious.
Okay, so that's kasu, K-A-S-U.
Yeah, right.
Makes sense because, the wine like muscadet is on lees.
Right.
Like fermented on lees. So like lees have a lot of agents to make
yes.
food or anything.
They really do. They have a lot of potential for that. And kasuzuke for fish, for example, like misozuke, you would make a bed for marinating. Probably marinating is a word that I would use rather than pickling, per se.
Mm.
And I think one of the important things, if people are going to, if listeners are going to try this on their own, is that you have a container that is not going to react with any of the food.
Mm.
So probably glass or enamel. In Japan, there's a lot of enamelware, koro ware, enamel line which doesn't react, or ceramic.
Right.
But it should not be metal or plastic.
Right. Well, actually, yeah, speaking of, let's talk about the container, because I think that's very unique and important
yes.
in Japanese pickling. So what do you need for? Is it the ceramic or the...
The material that it's made out of should be non-reactive. There shouldn't be any reaction between the container.
Mm.
So it's not like some wines where the oak barrel is... I mean, that may be part of it for things like shoyu for soy sauce and sake.
Mm.
But for most tsukemono, you're wanting a non-reactive container.
Mm.
And probably the easiest is glass or enamel lined or ceramic.
Right. Okay. And you need the pressure, right? Like weight.
So sometimes the pressure is as gentle as massaging your shoulders. And sometimes the pressure is more defined, and the proportion of weight that's on top is a definite formula relationship with the amount of food that's being pickled.
Right.
And that's true for a lot of the classic ones like umeboshi, the pickled plums, and also takuan, the radish.
Right.
There's a relationship between the amount of salt that's used and the food, but also the amount of weight that you put on top of it.
Right. Okay.
You don't want to crush it, but you do need to be able to encourage.
Mm. Right. Okay. So, yeah, it's like it can be, if it's a leafy vegetables, it can be 70% to 100% of the weight of the ingredients.
Right.
Before you you pickle.
Right.
And I think the root vegetables, 120%, 150%, that kind of like formula.
Right. So often nowadays there are specific stones of weights. There's a one. There's a 500 gram, a 1 kilo, a 2 kilo, and it's very easy to do your arithmetic. Probably the easiest for people who don't have something and they're trying to create their own setup is to use water. Water is quite heavy, but it's easy to discover how heavy it is by putting it in a measuring cup.
Right.
Because a liter of water is a kilo of weight.
Right, right, okay.
right. So if you put that on top of something, but there's also these cute little screw top gadgets.
Okay.
And I've seen a few of them at the Asian grocery stores here in America. It's got a long name, Shoktakutsuke Monoki. Shoktaku just means it sits on top of your table, and
right.
the screw top device. And what it enables you to do is apply very tight pressure, but then loosen it once the liquid has begun to rise.
Right.
And so the gadget has a plate that has holes in it so that liquid can actually rise above. Mm. And as soon as you see that there's a lot of liquid, you can reduce the amount of weight.
So convenient.
It is. Wow. But again, you're not wanting to crush the food. You're wanting to apply encouraging weight on top of it.
Okay, right. And there's so many things to cover, but I just wanted to, you know, mention some regional versions.
Yes.
And one of them, before the show, we were talking about Ibirigakko.
Right.
Right. So can you tell us about that, how unique it is?
In much of the Tohoku, and particularly the northeastern part of Japan, and particularly the part that's on the Sea of Japan side, so not the Pacific side of Japan, Yamagata, Akita in particular, in the winter, people have hearths, and it's quite cold.
Right.
And foods are often brought inside to dry above the hearth, so there would be this sort of smoky flavor that was imbued into the food. And in addition, it was recognized or noted that it encouraged good flavors and also, to some extent, preservatives.
Mm.
So the notion of smoke drying a vegetable and then pickling it developed in that part of Japan. And primarily it's daikon radishes, and they are, they smell like barbecue.
Right.
And they're pretty intense. Some of them do change a slight golden color.
Mm.
Sometimes that's encouraged with dried gardenia pods, kuchinashi no mi, that are added to make it bright yellow.
Mm.
But even without that, to some extent, they'll turn slightly yellow. And some of them are quite pale.
Mm.
What's notable, when you open the package, they may be available as vacuum seal packages from Japan. When you open it, it'll smell like a good barbecue sauce. Mm,
interesting. So speaking of, how do you incorporate tsukemono into a Japanese-style meal? Or can be Western-style?
I think so. It's wonderful with rice, of course, but also I think thinking of it as a salad, and particularly some of these sort of quicker chopped vegetable tsukemono, I would think of it as a salad that doesn't need any dressing. And it could also be a bed of vegetables that are on a plate, and perhaps a piece of broiled fish or meat is put on top of it.
Mm.
So as a sort of a side dish, a tsuke owase, something that's going to go with it. And then as snacks, they're some of them are really addictively good.
Right. And also if you have leftover rice.
Yeah.
Or, you know, at the end of the whole meal, the rice is a little leftover. They can put some tsukemono on top.
It's once you have them, there are just lots of ways you can think of using them.
Mm-hmm. But it's that the example of the ibirigako. It really tells you that it's so diverse depending on the region. And also, flavor can be barbecue, which is interesting.
It's really very, very different. And then there's, you know, umeboshi, which is sort of interesting because throughout Japan, everybody seems to make them. And there's relatively little difference throughout Japan in how they're made.
Okay. It's because it's a kind of personal, like house-made.
It is, but everybody, I'm not sure if it's because the science of it doesn't permit wide variation or whether everybody just discovered or decided that the way most people make it is the best way to make it. But when I think of other kinds of regional differences in tsukemono, for umeboshi, there's relatively little. Basically, there seem to be several different types. Most of them are the soft, squishy ume, but every once in a while you'll come across kari-kari ume, the little sort of very hard, they're not at all wrinkled.
Right.
I'm not a martini person, but people tell me they're great in martinis.
Ah, interesting.
Instead of olives. But most of them are soft and squishy, and if they have that intense pink color, it's because the akajiso leaves have been used. But there are people who don't. Then they turn to be a very pale, sort of dusty pink color.
Right.
And the liquid that's left after pickling the plums, umezu, is also used for other things. Other kinds of pickles, but also a delightful, if you add the equivalent of seltzer water to it, and make a delightful sort of spritzer.
Right. The color and the flavor.
The color, the flavor, and especially in the summertime, it's wonderfully refreshing.
Right. And also I think adds some sodium to your blood because it's you're sweating and it's refreshing.
Yes.
And it makes sense.
People are surprised when they first taste umezu how salty it is. And if it is indeed pure umezu, it's 15% to 20% sodium, because that's the proportion of plum to salt in making making the umeboshi. So the liquid is going to be that intense, and usually it's diluted.
Right, it's kind of like a sports drink.
Or matched with some sugar.
Right, so after you run or just take a walk, you sweat and you drink umezu.
Right.
Good for your health.
Yes.
Okay, and I heard that you tried to make takuan, which is another challenging...
My great disaster. I'm not sure that today's the day... I'm not sure when I'm going to have the confidence to post on Facebook some of the disastrous results. Every year when I start my takuan, I do a page.
Right. Takuan is basically usually bright yellow.
Right.
Which
it's daikon radish, right?
Daikon radish. And that color used to be natural. Nowadays, it's kind of a chemical. Right. But it's a nukazuke, right?
Right. It's a nukazuke, and my nuka pot is terrific. I think everybody who tastes them loves them, and it's great. But for whatever reason, takuan and I do not seem to get on. And every possible color and shape of mold that could possibly grow in a pot seems to grow in mine. And I have taken pictures every year of the disasters, but I've never posted them. I've only done posts on the preparation of... getting ready to pickle it and in the process of pickling it, but never when I finally remove the lid and take them out.
Interesting. So even Elizabeth, with the experience of 50 years, it could be challenging. So that's another interesting thing about pickling.
It is indeed, yeah.
Right? It's like gardening, maybe.
I think so. So the equivalent of not having a green thumb when it comes to takuan. I love them, and thankfully I have found... several producers of takuan, so I can enjoy theirs.
Right.
And every year I try. And anybody want to give me some pointers? I would love to hear them. But
so next time you come back, maybe you can just let me have a taste of your successful version of it.
I hope so. I can bring you some really good umeboshi.
Okay.
Yeah,
so let's take a look at what happened to what we made earlier.
Okay. So the first thing that's happened is a lot of liquid.
Right. Okay, wow.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's so much so that it leaked through the first bag. And mm-hmm. the other thing you have to remember about kombu, you could hear when I cracked it. Mm. It has sharp edges.
Right.
Okay. So either you're going to cut it very small, mm-hmm. and I probably didn't cut it small enough. So one of the pieces poked a hole in the first bag, and thankfully I had a second bag. And so now it's double bagged.
Right.
And I don't think, you'll tell me, I don't think we're going to have to rinse it off because it's probably not going to be all that terribly salty.
Mm-hmm.
But wow, I'm going to beautiful. Let you take a taste okay. and tell me what you think.
Let me have a taste.
Yep. Let's see. And we'll both crunch together.
Mm. Wow.
Mm.
Amazing. Serious.
And I think the hokusai is sweeter.
Mm.
Even though it's salt that has been added to it.
So
they haven't figured the technology yet for sharing food on radio, right?
I can just try to say it.
It's called a good imagination.
Mm. Hey. Well, it's seriously, the contrast between, you know, the salt and the sweet part of napa cabbage totally
yes.
came out.
Yes.
The umami of kombu quickly
right.
in 20
very
minutes.
Quickly. Yeah.
Wow, very impressive. So now I can pickle.
Right, you can pickle and tomorrow or the next day will be even better.
Okay,
yeah.
Right, because other enzyme comes into
yes.
this process.
Yeah. Right.
Right, so the amino acid breaks down and all those good stuff starts
the good
happening.
Stuff is going to start happening. Right.
How long does it last?
Probably you're going to eat it before there's going to be any problem, but mm-hmm. I would say at least 4 or 5 days.
Okay.
Right. And... interestingly, it will become more sour tasting as it develops, the enzymes get to work on it. But if when you open it, it has a rather sweet smell suddenly, that's a sign usually of spoilage.
Okay, right.
So when things have been sour up until then and suddenly they go sweet, that should be a red flag.
Okay.
That says probably it's not a great idea.
Right. But this is what they say. I don't think it's going to last more than 2 days.
I don't think so either. The other point that I'll make is that kombu, and it's the natural umami seibun, the natural glutamates that are in there, produces a kind of sticky substance.
Right.
And so you will find, I think slimy is both an unfortunate word and not, it's unfair to kombu to refer to it that way, but it has a sort of a sticky, almost a viscous
like a
kind
gooey,
of.
It's
yeah. So don't be surprised. That's not any sign of spoilage. That's a sign that the umami is going to work
right.
on it all. So that's good.
Okay.
Right.
Right. All right. So, and you have a recipe that
yes,
be downloadable.
So if you go to tasteofculture.com, my main website, and I have a sort of a blog page called Kitchen Culture, and I've just uploaded one on, and you'll see a picture in which I also had some shredded, you know, you peel carrots,
mm-hmm.
and so those peels should never go to waste, and they're also great in the same mixture.
Mm.
So I'm quite sure the picture that I have up on the, I'm trying to remember which one I finally chose, has carrot shreds in
okay.
there as well. And you can download a recipe and give me a couple of hours before I can upload also
the
story on my pickle
yeah,
pot.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that Daily Yomiuri article.
Okay,
right,
very
so,
good.
Okay, so thank you for joining us today, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
And hope to see you again soon.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you'd like to know more about Elizabeth's project, and please visit again, it's tasteofculture.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher Podcast. And today's engineer is Vittorio Hash. And thank you for listening, and I will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.